Roosevelt. It would seem incredible that anyone would care one way or the other about your playing golf, a worried Roosevelt wrote to Taft. But he had received literally hundreds of letters from the West protesting about it. Because the working class looked upon golf as a rich man's game, Roosevelt cautioned his friend to suppress future reports about his golf game. Nor should he even permit himself to be photographed on the golf course, for the American people regard the campaign as a very serious business. Taft insisted that he was working very hard, but acknowledged that appearances could be misleading. As the general election drew near, Roosevelt continued to hover about Taft like a hen over her chickens. Early on, Taft had pledged to make public all campaign contributions as soon as the election was over. Realizing such transparency might paralyze large donors, Taft told the president that he was willing to undergo the disadvantage in order to make certain that in future we shall reduce the power of money in politics. Republican fundraising did, in fact, suffer. "I must tell you plainly," Taft's treasurer, George Sheldon, protested, "that your pledge has tied my hands and at least one of my legs, and I am well-nigh helpless." The nominee caused further consternation when he refused a $50,000 check from William Cromwell, a friend who had donated, despite knowledge his contribution would be public record. Taft told Cromwell he could not accept such a large sum from anyone outside his own family. Though he realized the gift was prompted by nothing but the purest friendship, he feared the size would be misunderstood. Roosevelt disagreed. "I have always said you would be the greatest president," he chided Taft, "but really, I think you are altogether oversensitive. If I were in your place, I should accept that contribution of Cromwell's with real gratitude." Taft finally agreed to accept a $10,000 check with the understanding that the amount could be increased if necessary. Facing a host of difficulties even before the traditional Labor Day opening for the fall campaign, Taft confessed to Roosevelt that he felt somewhat chagrined about his chances. "Don't get one particle discouraged," Roosevelt assured him. "You have exactly the right attitude of mind in the matter. In 1904, I never permitted myself to regard the election as anything but doubtful." In truth, Taft had reason to worry. William Jennings Bryan had become a far more formidable candidate since his previous runs in 1896 or 1900. In those earlier campaigns, Chicago journalist Walter Wellman noted, many had viewed Bryan as a dangerous man, revolutionary, socialist, and by some, almost an anarchist. With the rise of Theodore Roosevelt and the progressive wing of the Republican Party, however, many policies championed by the Democratic candidate had become law. No longer an outcast, Bryan pronounced himself a more legitimate heir to Roosevelt than Taft, promising that a Democratic majority would break the stranglehold of Republican conservatives on Congress. Taft's political strategists were initially reluctant to send their candidate on a speaking tour, preferring to run a front porch campaign from his brother's home in Cincinnati. They feared Taft would be placed at a disadvantage, appearing on the stump against the gifted Nebraskan. Once again, Taft's principles collided with their strategy. "If the candidate does not go out and work himself," he told Roosevelt, "the subordinates in the ranks are not liable to tear their shirts, whereas the personal presence of the man at the head will have an encouraging and stimulating effect." At Taft's direction, party strategists designed a strenuous tour, focusing mainly in the West and Midwest, where Bryan was gaining substantial momentum. Fearing that Taft would be too reticent on the stump, Roosevelt barraged him with incessant speech-making advice. "Do not answer Bryan. Attack him," he counseled in early September, adding, "Don't let him make the issues." A week later, the president resumed. "Hit them hard, old man," he encouraged, offering a slew of new suggestions. "Let the audience see you smile always, because I feel that your nature shines out so transparently when you do smile. You big, generous, high-minded fellow. Moreover, let them realize the truth, which is that for all your gentleness and kindliness, and generous good nature, there never existed a man who was a better fighter when the need arose." Taft promised to confront Bryan directly, but he remained reluctant to launch an uncharacteristic dramatic offensive. "I cannot be more aggressive than my nature makes me," he told a concerned supporter. "That is the advantage and the disadvantage of having been on the bench. I can't call names, and I can't use adjectives when I don't think the case calls for them. So you will have to get along with that kind of a candidate." "I am not very pleased with the way Taft's campaign is being handled," Roosevelt complained to his son-in-law, Nicholas Longworth, adding, "I do wish that Taft would put more energy and fight into the matter." Constitutionally incapable of remaining on the sidelines, Roosevelt decided to put a little vim into the campaign with a series of public letters. The first of these missives challenged Bryan's claim that he, rather than Taft, was the president's natural successor. "The true friend of reform," Roosevelt clarified, "is the man who steadily perseveres in righting wrongs, in warring against abuses, but whose character and training are such that he never promises what he cannot perform, and that, while steadily advancing, he never permits himself to be led into foolish excesses. William Howard Taft combines all of these qualities to a degree which no man in our public life since the Civil War has surpassed," he ardently insisted. "For the last 10 years," he added, "I have been thrown into the closest intimacy with him, and he and I have, on every essential point, stood in heartiest agreement, shoulder to shoulder." Bryan's further assertion that Roosevelt's views aligned more closely with the Democratic platform than with the agenda of his own Republican Party prompted a fiery exchange between the two men. "You say that your platform declares in favor of the vigorous enforcement of the law against guilty trust magnates and officials," Roosevelt noted, "and that the platform upon which Mr. Taft stands makes no such declaration. It was not necessary. That platform approved the policies of this administration." He pointed out that under Grover Cleveland, the last Democratic president, not a single antitrust case was instituted, nor was action taken to stop rebates. Deeds, he argued in a further exchange, were far more important than words. Roosevelt's fiery declarations put Bryan on the defensive and spurred the sluggish Republican campaign. "Bryan walked into a trap," Taft gratefully told Roosevelt, "and that gave you an opportunity, at his instance, to hit him 2 or 3 blows between the eyes." "Throughout the West," Taft added, "Bryan's claim to be the heir of your policies is now the subject of laughter and ridicule rather than of serious weight." Ascribing the revival of the Republican campaign to his pugnacious friend, Taft overlooked his own winning impression made at every stop. The Taft special, which carried him to 21 states in 41 days, consisted of 4 cars, a private car for the nominee and his guests, a dining car, a sleeping car for the newspaper men, and a baggage car. Addressing friendly crowds at each city and town along the whistle-stop tour, Taft proved to be a good deal more of a speaker than most of those present had counted on hearing. "While he was in no sense a professional entertainer," one reporter remarked, "his words displayed such openness and were uttered with such conviction that he strengthened himself in the hearts of his hearers." Audiences invariably came away persuaded that Taft was on the level, that he told the truth about himself, and stated his thoughts without equivocation. "That man has a fine face," one spectator enthused. "I would trust him anywhere." As the crowds continued to grow, Taft became more confident in his oratory. "I have been in real touch with the people," he proudly observed. "They have come to see me and hear me in numbers far beyond my anticipation, and what seems of even more importance, they have responded to what I have had to say in a way that I could feel their sympathy." "You are making such a success with your speeches," Nellie wrote from New York, where she was busy settling her children into their various schools. For weeks, she had been nettled by gossip that Roosevelt was disappointed by Taft's inability to generate campaign momentum. Now, these sanguine reports of the whistle-stop tour left her treading on air. The president, she informed her husband, had requested a meeting with her. "I can't imagine what Teddy wants," she wrote, "but probably only to complain of something." Nellie was mistaken. In fact, the president was growing more confident about Taft's prospects in the general election. Recognizing Taft's speaking tour had invigorated the campaign, he simply wanted to share his enthusiasm with her. "Nellie had a most delightful time," Will wrote afterward to Roosevelt. "You gave her courage and hope." Expressing a similar optimism to Kermit in late October, Roosevelt wrote that the political outlook had changed materially for the better. He was now certain, he told his son, that Taft would be elected. To everyone's relief, the speaking tour had succeeded tremendously, an achievement for which Roosevelt did not hesitate to take credit, forgetting that Taft had done yeoman work in both his 1904 and 1906 campaigns. Archie Butt told of his amusement at the president's skewed recounting of how he transformed Taft from a soporific lecturer into a popular draw. "I told him he simply had to stop saying what he had said in this or that decision. For at that point, people promptly begin to nod. I told him that he must treat the political audience as one coming not to see an etching, but a poster. He must, therefore, have streaks of blue, yellow, and red to catch the eye and eliminate all fine lines and soft colors. I think Mr. Taft thought I was a barbarian and a mountebank at first, but I am pleased to say that he is at last catching the attention of the crowd." Such indiscretions invariably filtered into Taft's camp, fueling resentment at the president's condescending and potentially damaging self-aggrandizement. Taft's supporters had long felt that Roosevelt was keeping himself too much in the limelight, creating the impression that Taft was incapable of standing on his own feet. Always gracious, Taft assured Roosevelt that he did not know who had spread rumors that his people were rankled by the president's active role. Personally, he had been very touched by Roosevelt's speech-making advice and delighted by everything done to support him. Nellie joined Taft in Buffalo on the last day of his speaking tour. In western New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, they were met by monster crowds brimming with enthusiasm. Reporters noted that Nellie seemed to enjoy it immensely. They reached Cincinnati at 8 a.m. on November 3rd, spending the day at Charlie's home before going to vote in the afternoon. In preparation for receiving the election returns, Charlie had converted the veranda into a telegraph room with wires directly connected to the National Republican headquarters in New York, Western Union, the Associated Press, and the United Press. The extended family and friends gathered in the large drawing room, surrounded by the exquisite art collection Charles and Annie had assembled during their sojourns in Europe. Newspapermen who had traveled with the candidate on the whistle-stop tour joined them. Gus Karger, the Cincinnati Times reporter, who had served as Taft's publicity agent during the campaign, read the returns. Early reports from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, and Maryland soon indicated a magnificent victory for William Howard Taft. The excited candidate paced throughout the evening, exhibiting the finest specimen of that smile which the campaign had made famous. At 8:45, he finally agreed to make a statement. "Just say that everything looks favorable," he directed modestly. Nellie was more forthcoming, exclaiming, "I was never so happy in my life." Though Taft's popular margin was only half the size of Roosevelt's 1904 victory, he carried 29 of the 46 states, beating Bryan by over 1.25 million votes. Later that night, Taft delivered a short speech with his distinctive, self-effacing sincerity. "I pledge myself to use all the energy and ability in me to make the next administration a worthy successor to that of Theodore Roosevelt," he said. "I could have no higher aim than that." At the White House, Archie Butt reported, Roosevelt was simply radiant over Taft's victory and made no attempt to disguise it, interpreting the victory as a vindication of his own policies. When the conversation turned to Taft's struggle to lose weight through golf and horseback riding, the president offered pithy advice. "If I were Taft, I would not attempt to take much exercise. I would content myself with the record I was able to make in the next 4 years, or the next 8, and then be content to die." Taft addressed his very first letter as president-elect to his friend and mentor, Theodore Roosevelt. "My selection and election are chiefly your work," he told him. "You and my brother Charlie made that possible which, in all probability, would not have occurred otherwise." In later years, Roosevelt would express resentment at being yoked with Taft's brother as a joint benefactor, heedless that Charlie's decades of financial support had enabled Will to sustain a career in public service. At that moment, however, Roosevelt responded with unalloyed joy. "You have won a great personal victory as well as a great victory for the party," the president wrote. "And all those who love you, who admire and believe in you, and are proud of your great and fine qualities, must feel a thrill of exultation." Chapter 22. A Great Stricken Animal. Henry Adams, scion of two presidents and an acute student of American political life for nearly seven decades, called William Howard Taft the best-equipped man for the presidency who had been suggested by either party during his lifetime. A prominent New Yorker argued that Taft was the greatest all-around man ever to reach the White House. As Congressman James E. Watson noted, he had served with great success in every subordinate post he had occupied. From his early days as Solicitor General to his Governor Generalship of the Philippines to his tenure as Secretary of War, Taft had proved himself reliable, hardworking, and loyal. On those rare occasions when he disagreed with a superior, he kept his dissent private. Nor had he objected when credit for his achievements was extended to others. "The most difficult instrument to play in the orchestra is second fiddle," the conductor Leonard Bernstein once noted. Yet for nearly two decades, Taft had performed with unfailing mastery. Whether the skills of this exemplary subordinate were the requisite skills to lead a nation remained the only unanswered question. Ray Baker suggested that sometimes the second fiddler may be a more accomplished musician than the first, but he could not fill the first fiddler's place. He has not the audience sense. He does not know how to handle men. He has not the ability to beat disharmonies into harmonies. As leadership scholars observe, not everyone was meant to be number one. Within hours of his election triumph, Taft was already anguished that his nature was ill-suited to his new role. He spoke like a man, one insider noted, whose job had got him down even before he tackled it. In one of his first statements, Taft predicted that his friends and acquaintances would soon shake their heads and say, "Poor Bill." Not long afterward, he responded to confident remarks on the prospects of his administration with a trembling fear that in 4 years' time he would be like the man who went into office with a majority and went out with unanimity. Yet with each substantial step in his successful career, Taft had overcome similar waves of grave doubt and anxiety. As Solicitor General, despite fearing in his first days that the demand for a one-sided argument would prove incompatible with his temperament, he had quickly developed into an effective advocate, winning a large majority of the government's cases. When initially approached to govern the Philippines, he had protested that he was not the right man for the job. He left that position with an international reputation as a successful administrator. Sitting on the lid, as acting president during Roosevelt's two-month vacation, he had deftly defused a number of potentially explosive situations. And painfully aware of his deficiencies as a campaigner, he had nevertheless bested all rivals to win both the Republican nomination and the general election. Through all these challenges, Taft had relied on the guidance of a superior. Now, for the first time, he was truly on his own. Faced with the complicated task of shaping a cabinet, Taft sought escape. He traveled first to Hot Springs, Virginia, and then to Augusta, Georgia, where he stayed for 6 weeks in a comfortable cottage adjacent to the luxury Bonaire Hotel, widely celebrated for its splendid 18-hole golf course and the handsomest clubhouse in the South. While Nellie thought the location too remote to accurately gauge the tenor of Washington, Taft insisted on getting away for a complete rest. He defiantly proposed to spend his time working at sleeping and playing golf. Clearly, there was much preparatory work for the presidency, but Taft's dilatory nature took hold, and he refused to consider a single appointment until he was good and ready. In the interim, he would do his part to make golf one of the popular outdoor exercises in the country. Each evening, groups of leading citizens vied to entertain the Tafts. A committee in Atlanta decorated the city with flags and bunting in preparation for the president-elect's appearance at an elaborate possum and taters banquet. Newspapers described a specially constructed cage that housed each arriving batch of 20 possums, until 100 were gathered to feed 600 guests. Featuring vaudeville acts, songs, and the release of doves, the gala evening was ranked the most brilliant event ever held in Atlanta, marking a social epic in the history of the New South. A cartoon of Taft as Billy Possum prompted a toy maker to patent a new stuffed animal. But expectations that Billy Possum would rival the teddy bear in popularity were swiftly dashed when the stuffed creature, resembling a gigantic rat, caused children to cry. Taft's sojourn at the Bonaire Hotel provided a happy respite, enabling him to enjoy the honor without the responsibilities of the office. For the first time in months, the entire family was together. Robert and Helen arrived from Yale and Bryn Mawr, and the families of Charles and Harry Taft stayed for several weeks, along with Taft's good friend John Hayes Hammond. Splendid weather afforded long hours on the golf links, day-long fishing excursions, and automobile rambles around the countryside. "He is so genial, so companionable, so gentlemanly," a woman remarked, "that one is apt to forget that he is the president-elect." By postponing cabinet decisions, however, Taft inadvertently fueled speculation and rumor. Conventional wisdom suggested that after repeated pledges to support Roosevelt's policies, the new president would retain most of his predecessor's cabinet. Taft had even conveyed a message to Roosevelt for his cabinet colleagues. "Tell the boys I have been working with that I want to continue all of them. They are all fine fellows, and they have been mighty good to me. I want all of them to stay just as they are." In the months that followed, Taft began to recognize the necessity of establishing an independent identity, particularly after the barrage of criticism that accompanied his humiliating pilgrimage to Oyster Bay to consult Roosevelt on his acceptance speech. Throughout the campaign, Taft had stressed the very different challenges that would confront his own prospective administration. Roosevelt, Taft repeatedly explained, had launched a successful crusade against the abuses of industry and aroused the people to demand reform. Now, Taft said, the time had come to perfect the necessary regulatory machinery and to craft amendments that would ensure proper enforcement. To accomplish these ends, a different sensibility and different personnel might be required. Notwithstanding, the first man invited into Taft's cabinet was Roosevelt's trusted Secretary of State, Elihu Root. In the cabinet's premier post, Root would provide the anchor in Roosevelt's absence. Looking back on his achievement in the Philippines, the president-elect attributed much of his success to the detailed instructions, goals, and framework Root had furnished. "I merely followed the way opened up by Root," he insisted. Indeed, after his election, Taft went so far as to tell an audience that the administration was topsy-turvy. "Root ought to be pres-elect," he insisted, "and I ought to be a prospective member of his cabinet, because I know how to serve under him." Such sentiments cannot be simply construed as extravagant humility or an odd, self-disparaging humor. Rather, like his chronic procrastination, they connote tentativeness, a want of confidence arising from underlying insecurity. Root was sorely tempted to accept Taft's offer. "I would rather stay here than do anything else," he told a friend, "but between rheumatism and the climate and the incessant and wearisome pressure of social duties, I am satisfied that it would mean a complete breakdown of Mrs. Root's health." With Root out of the running, Taft turned next to another intimate of his predecessor, Henry Cabot Lodge. Though touched and gratified, Lodge nonetheless felt that he could be of greater service to the country by remaining in the Senate. After conferring with Roosevelt, Taft finally offered the post to former Attorney General Philander Knox, then a Pennsylvania senator. "Knox called on me last night," Roosevelt informed Taft several days later. "I had a long talk over his accepting the position of Secretary of State, and I am confident that he will do so." 5 days later, Knox sent a telegram confirming his acceptance. Taft told Roosevelt he was planning to invite Knox to Augusta, hoping to secure guidance on his remaining choices. There, Knox would be joined by Taft's campaign chair, Frank Hitchcock, slated to become Postmaster General. "Ha, ha," Roosevelt jested. "You are making up your cabinet. I, in a light-hearted way, have spent the morning testing the rifles for my African trip. Life has compensations." Taft's initial assurance that he would retain the entire cabinet proved particularly troublesome when he subsequently decided to replace Luke Wright as Secretary of War. When Taft had resigned his own cabinet post the previous July after securing the Republican nomination, Roosevelt had wanted Wright, Taft's successor as Governor General in the Philippines, to replace him. Worried that Wright would decline a term of only 9 months, Roosevelt had asked Taft if he could offer the inducement of a longer tenure should he win the election. Taft had confirmed that he would be more than pleased to continue Wright, and Roosevelt could relay that message. Once Taft had the choice in his hands, however, he hesitated, concerned that Wright was not decisive enough, and tended to let questions settle themselves without mental action by him. Instead, he selected another Southern Democrat, Jacob Dickinson. While rethinking a key appointment was surely Taft's prerogative, he exacerbated the awkward situation and irritated Roosevelt by failing to inform Wright until mid-February 1909, just weeks before the inauguration. In the end, no appointment would have more far-reaching consequences for Taft's administration than his decision to replace Interior Secretary James Garfield with Richard Ballinger. Roosevelt had pushed to retain Garfield from the outset. "I didn't have to be hit with a club 10 times a day to understand the workings of his mind," Taft later remarked. No two young men in the Roosevelt administration had been closer to the president than Garfield and Gifford Pinchot. Pinchot had driven Roosevelt's conservation fight. Garfield had served for 7 years, first as Civil Service Commissioner, then as head of the Bureau of Corporations, and finally as Secretary of the Interior, where he worked closely with Pinchot. A peculiar intimacy bonded the trio, Roosevelt reflected, because all three of us have worked for the same causes, have dreamed the same dreams, have felt a substantial identity of purpose. Garfield had every reason to believe that Taft would ask him to stay. As one of Taft's staunchest supporters during the fight for nomination and election, Garfield had delivered scores of speeches in Ohio and chaired the convention in Columbus that provided an early boost to Taft's candidacy. Furthermore, Garfield was connected with Taft personally as well as politically. He and his wife Helen socialized with Will and Nellie, dining at each other's houses and vacationing together. Their son John attended Horace Taft School in Connecticut. The press assumed that Garfield would not only stay on in Taft's cabinet, but would likely become an important member of the new president's inner circle. Yet almost immediately after his election, Taft began searching for someone to replace Garfield. Although Taft considered Garfield an accomplished bureau chief, he did not think him big enough for a cabinet position. He was convinced that Pinchot dominated Garfield, and did not relish the thought of Pinchot running the Interior Department in addition to the Forestry Bureau. While he recognized Pinchot's vital role in securing Roosevelt's conservation legacy, Taft believed that some of his executive policies and land withdrawals had not merely strained but broken existing law. Geographic representation also weighed heavily in Taft's rationale. Garfield hailed from Ohio, the state of the president-elect himself, while the West Coast clamored for someone to represent their interests. Taft's choice, Richard Ballinger, had been a reform mayor in Seattle before joining the Roosevelt administration as head of the land office, where he was regarded as an ardent conservationist and an excellent administrator. By the time Ballinger returned to his Seattle law practice in 1908, Garfield was deeply impressed with his work. "He has done admirably," he noted, "and leaves with a reputation for ability, industry, and fairness." When first approached to join Taft's cabinet, Ballinger regretfully declined, citing limited personal means and the promise to his wife that they would remain in Seattle. After further conversations, however, he was finally persuaded. Had Taft taken Garfield into his confidence early on, perhaps explaining the necessity of geographical balance, he might have avoided future conflict. But instead, he said nothing. Beyond his initial choice of Knox and Hitchcock, Taft remained silent regarding further appointments until he could assemble a complete cabinet. In late December, rumors circulated that Garfield was out of the running, leaving the Interior Secretary in an embarrassing position. "I'm utterly at sea," Garfield recorded in his journal on January 11th, observing with frustration, "If he wishes me to stay, he should ask me soon. If not, he surely owes it to me, because of our relations during many years and close association recently, to frankly tell me so." When no announcement was forthcoming by late January, the press speculated that Garfield might be chosen after all, and attributed the delay to the difficult process of constructing a balanced, cooperative cabinet, a particular challenge for a genial, agreeable man, averse to making enemies or disappointing ambition. Yet the longer Taft withheld selections, the more anxious Garfield grew. "Rumors and more rumors, but he says nothing," he reported, calling Taft's procrastination an astounding condition of affairs and wholly without reasonable explanation. Garfield was not the only former Roosevelt cabinet officer bewildered and exasperated by Taft's inaction. Gossip filled the vacuum. Word spread that Taft had completely changed his mind, deciding to keep no one associated with his predecessor, so that his administration could stand on its own merits. While Roosevelt publicly defended Taft's right to choose his own men in his own way, he advised the president-elect to inform those he did not intend to reappoint immediately. "They will be making their plans, and less than 2 months remain, and I do not think they ought to be left in doubt," Roosevelt told Taft. "Of course, I am perfectly willing to tell them if you will write me to do so." "I think I ought to do it myself," Taft replied. Yet he continued to wait more than 2 weeks before sending a half dozen letters simultaneously. Each began with the same stilted phrase: "The President has thought that you were entitled to the notice of my cabinet plans insofar as to advise you that in the list of my cabinet I have not been able to include your name." The recipients, all formerly Taft's intimate colleagues, were understandably hurt by this impersonal and awkward manner of address. In the end, despite the fact that two additional members of Roosevelt's cabinet, George Meyer and James Wilson, joined Secretary of State Philander Knox in the new administration, the overriding impression was of a clean sweep of Roosevelt's team. "TR's trusty aides all to walk plank," announced the Cleveland Press. "Taft seems bent upon dumping his old associates in his cabinet." Taft asserted that he had simply examined each position and carefully considered the best men to comprise the new administration. "I have my own record to make," he maintained, "and my own place to secure in the confidence of the country." Proponents of Roosevelt's agenda, however, began to question the president-elect's strategy. "If Taft is going to fire all his old associates in the Roosevelt administration, how is he going to make good his pledge to carry on the Roosevelt policies? Why, if he intends to finish the Roosevelt program, does he get rid of all the men trained in the Roosevelt school?" In addition, Roosevelt supporters voiced concern over the preponderance of corporate lawyers in the new cabinet. Roosevelt himself could not help but feel a little cast down by Taft's dealings and decisions as he assembled his cabinet. Still, he continued to profess belief in his old friend. "They little realize that Taft is big enough to carve out his own administration on individual lines," he told Archie Butt. "I predict a brilliant administration for him. I felt he was the one man for the presidency, and any failure in it would be as keenly felt by me as by himself or his family." While Taft's system may be different, the president predicted, the results will be the same. After announcing his cabinet choices, Taft wrote a long letter to Roosevelt. People have attempted to represent that you and I were in some way at odds during this last 3 months, he explained. Whereas you know, and I know, that there has not been the slightest difference between us. Indeed, the two men had spent many hours together during the transition. Through conversations and correspondence, Taft had kept Roosevelt informed on each cabinet decision and had shared an early draft of his inaugural address. How could I but be delighted with your inaugural? Roosevelt responded. It is simply fine in every way, and it marks just exactly what your administration will be. Taft's final letter to Roosevelt before he assumed the presidency expressed renewed appreciation for his old friend's breadth of soul and mind and magnanimity. Roosevelt replied with an equal warmth and affection. Your letter, he wrote, was so very nice. Nice isn't anything like a strong enough word, but at the moment, to use words as strong as I feel, would look sloppy. Roosevelt made no secret of his reluctance to leave office. If I had conscientiously felt at liberty to run again and try once more to hold this great office, he acknowledged, I should greatly have liked to do so, and to continue to keep my hands on the levers of this mighty machine. In his last annual message to Congress, he had firmly declared that he felt none of the weariness of public life, which 7 tumultuous years might well have produced. Although conservative leaders in the House and Senate had successfully blocked most of his proposals for 2 straight years, Roosevelt remained undaunted. In a sweeping valedictory message of more than 21,000 words, the outgoing president expounded his whole social philosophy and urged Congress to carry into effect the new spirit of democracy, reinforcing federal power to address present-day social and economic problems. He is as voluminous as ever, the New York Tribune remarked. If only a fraction of the laws that Roosevelt advocated were passed, another reporter observed, they would commit the country to a course of new experiments and make over the face of the social creation. He wanted authority over telegraph and telephone companies, along with railroads, placed in the hands of the Interstate Commerce Commission. He called for greater regulation of interstate corporations, prohibition of child labor, enforcement of an 8-hour workday, strengthening of workmen's compensation, the establishment of a postal savings system, and an inheritance tax. The danger to American democracy lies not in the least in the concentration of administrative power in responsible and accountable hands, he argued. It lies in having the power insufficiently concentrated, so that no one can be held responsible to the people for its use. What might have been interpreted as an infringement upon liberty before the Industrial Revolution and the rise of massive corporations may be the necessary safeguard of liberty today. Within this new industrial context, he criticized the courts for ruling unconstitutional various state laws designed to remedy social problems, arrogating to themselves functions which properly belong to legislative bodies. Finally, Roosevelt rounded on Congress. For 2 decades, the executive departments had deployed members of the Secret Service to ferret out land frauds, violations in antitrust laws, and, on rare occasions, illegal actions perpetrated by senators or congressmen themselves. The previous year, however, Congress had passed an amendment preventing the Secret Service from pursuing such investigations. Incensed, Roosevelt charged that no one but members of the criminal class could benefit from such an amendment. Clearly, congressmen did not themselves wish to be investigated. Roosevelt's comments provoked a storm of censure from Republicans and Democrats alike. Senator Aldrich introduced a resolution challenging the president to produce evidence of congressional misbehavior, while Senators Bailey and Tillman huffily defended the self-respect and integrity of fellow legislators. Adamantly refusing to retract his charge, Roosevelt fired off a 6,000-word response that targeted specific members of Congress, including Minnesota Representative James Tawney and Senators Tillman and Bailey. Pandemonium broke loose, the Times reported. In return, Congress took a rare measure not utilized since Jackson's presidency, reprimanding Roosevelt with an overwhelming 212-35 vote to reject his message on the ground that it lacked due respect. Despite such overwhelming resistance, Roosevelt held fast to his position. Congress, of course, feels that I will never again have to be reckoned with, and that it is safe to be ugly with me, he confided to Kermit, admitting, I am not having an easy time. Even as he acknowledged that it is a president's duty to get on with Congress if he possibly can, and that it is a reflection upon him if he and Congress come to a complete break, he nevertheless insisted that he must continue to fight hard on the issue of corruption, a touchstone of his presidency, or be put in a contemptible position. Although this bitter struggle ended his days in Washington on a disagreeable note, he took pride that he had exercised his presidential powers right up to the end. During the final weeks of the Roosevelt administration, a mood of sadness enveloped the White House. I have never seen so much feeling in evidence in all my life, Archie Budd observed as this vital stage in the lives of both the president and his colleagues drew to a close. As the chief military aide, the 43-year-old Captain Butt had developed an intimate relationship with both the President and First Lady. His warmth, flair for conversation, and love of books had made him a welcome companion at Sagamore Hill and scores of White House lunches and dinners. A graduate of the University of the South in Tennessee, Archie had worked as a journalist for nearly a decade before volunteering for service during the Spanish-American War. Remaining in the military, he had served in the Quartermaster Department in the Philippines, Cuba, and Washington before Roosevelt brought him to the White House. Bud had begun his duties believing thoroughly in the real greatness of the president, and the weeks and months spent with the family had not altered his original judgment. He had traveled with the Roosevelts on overnight trips, joined them for horseback rides, tennis games, and scrambles through Rock Creek Park, always assuming his duties with a boyish delight and a relish for all the gay doings of the White House. Archie Butt had grown especially close to Edith Roosevelt. She is perfectly poised, and nothing seems to annoy her, the 43-year-old bachelor told his mother, lauding Edith's ever-softening influence on her volatile husband. Even while drawing a protective curtain around her family, Edith had unfailingly carried out social obligations with natural elegance. Formerly, Butt remarked, the smart element of society had been wont to sneer at the garish nature of public entertainments at the White House. Under Edith Roosevelt, however, functions were smaller, less frequent, and more formal. Guests were required to present cards, and soon smart society clamored for invitations. Edith's Friday evening musicales attracted the nation's finest performers, including Ignaz Jan Paderewski, the concert pianist, and the cellist Pablo Casals. If social affairs have thus become less democratic, they have also become more dignified, remarked one reporter. Were we living in the days of chivalry, Butt confessed with grandiose nostalgia, I could easily believe myself in the role of knight for a mistress so gentle, so sweet, and so altogether lovely. The ball rolls faster as it nears the bottom, Captain Butt observed as the Roosevelt administration drew to a close in early February. The White House calendar was filled every minute with brilliant but melancholy events. The last Army and Navy reception, the last meeting with the diplomatic corps. Several of the ministers and ambassadors actually wept as they said goodbye, Butt recounted. The wife of the Japanese ambassador could not say a word but burst out crying, and the ambassador was not much better. Later that same afternoon, Edith Roosevelt finally had a good cry of her own. But when the president attempted to comfort her, he broke down himself. For his final public journey, Roosevelt chose to deliver a speech at Knob Creek Farm in Kentucky, birthplace of his hero, Abraham Lincoln. He had ordered his train route withheld from the newspapers, fearing he would be met with diminished enthusiasm as his presidency neared its end. For the first hour there were no yells, Archie Butt recorded, and Roosevelt looked forlorn as he gazed out at calm streets and empty platforms. Before long, however, the train schedule leaked. Suddenly, throngs materialized at every spot along the way. Families and children stood at tiny intersections. In larger towns, thousands assembled to wave and cheer, wishing their president a final farewell. He jumped from his seat as readily for a half dozen people at a road crossing as he would for a crowd at a station, Archie Butt marveled. At one point, Roosevelt rushed to the platform to greet a single woman in a field, prompting recollection of an earlier trip when he found himself waving frantically at a herd of cows. With deadpan mirth, Roosevelt remembered that he had met with an indifferent, if not a cold, reception. On March 1st, Roosevelt hosted perhaps the most colorful official luncheon on record. "The papers have made a good deal of fun of my tennis cabinet," he playfully observed, "but they have never known how extensive or what a part it has played in my administrations. It will be gathered together today for the first time. 31 members of this fabulously eclectic tennis cabinet, Roosevelt's hunting companions, sparring partners, tennis mates, and fellow rock climbers, would attend. In order that various elements of this informal cabinet might get acquainted, the president told Archie Butt to seat them irrespective of rank. Jules Jusserand, the French ambassador, and cabinet members James Garfield, Truman Newberry, and George Meyer should enjoy the company of the wolf hunters and the two-gun men." Needless to say, this convergence of disparate worlds made quite an impression. "Is there any other man," Madame Jusserand exclaimed, "who could have had on one side of him the ambassador of a great country, and on the other a desperado from Oklahoma?" Throughout the lunch, Roosevelt spoke of his relationship with each of the men in turn. According to Archie Butt, there was not a dry eye around all that table. The Roosevelts chose to spend March 3, 1909, their last night in the White House, with the Tafts. Arriving in the late afternoon, Will and Nellie were escorted to a bedroom suite on the second floor, later designated the Lincoln Bedroom. It was a curious occasion, Alice Roosevelt Longworth recalled. There were the Tafts, about to take over, obviously being tactful, soft-peddling their natural elation. For everyone else, like an obscuring fog, was the inevitable melancholy of saying goodbye, of closing the door on great times, the interests, the personal associations, the power, all over, gone. Even Archie Butt, who would remain at his post with the new president, was frankly emotional, and Elihu Root was in such low spirits that tears brimmed from his eyes. The dinner would have been hopeless, Archie Butt remarked, had it not been for the president, who lightened the mood with one entertaining story after another. Regardless of Roosevelt's efforts, everyone seemed relieved when the meal and Elihu Root was in such low spirits that tears brimmed from his eyes. The dinner would have been hopeless, Archie Butt remarked, had it not been for the president, who lightened the mood with one entertaining story after another. Regardless of Roosevelt's efforts, everyone seemed relieved when the meal ended. In customary fashion, couples separated, the men going to the president's upstairs study while the women congregated in the library. Sometime after 10 p.m., Taft rose to keep his promised appearance at a Yale smoker in his honor at the Willard Hotel. His departure brought the evening to an end, leaving only Theodore, Edith, Nellie, and Captain Butt. "Mrs. Roosevelt finally arose," Butt wrote, "and said she would go to her room and advised Mrs. Taft to do the same. She took her hand kindly and expressed the earnest hope that her first night in the White House would be one of sweet sleep." Taft remained at the smoker until midnight, his late return to the White House provoking a widely read spoof in the New York Sun the next day. A fictional dispatch portrayed a weary Taft trudging upstairs, whereupon a servant announced that the president awaited him. And there before him stood Roosevelt, broadsword in hand. "Thought you'd like a short bout before turning in," Roosevelt offered. "Here, get this mask and these pads on. Here are the gauntlets." Taft barely had time to don his equipment before Roosevelt struck three decisive blows. "Now we'll have a little wrestling," he suggested. And as if by magic, the mattress was spread. Almost instantly, Taft was on his back. Exulting in triumph, Roosevelt asked the servants to set up the rings and parallel bars. For 30 minutes they took turns until Roosevelt mercifully declared himself the clear victor. Finally, at 3 a.m., the sun fancied, the two athletes went to bed. In fact, by the time Taft returned to the White House, the Roosevelts had long since retired. Only Nellie, too excited to sleep, had waited up. For weeks, she had been preoccupied with the inaugural festivities, and everything had been meticulously arranged. Everything except the weather. A soggy, wet snow had been falling all day. The storm was supposed to end by morning, but the wind gusting over the water shunted it back angrier than before, and the nation's capital found itself bound hand and foot by the worst blizzard since 1888. Gale winds howled, tree limbs cracked under the weight of the heavy snow, and streets were covered with a slick slush. It was really very serious, Nellie recalled. Railroad and telegraphic communications were paralyzed all along the Atlantic coast. On March 4th, inaugural day, the president and president-elect met for an early breakfast. "The storm will soon be over," Roosevelt sardonically predicted. "As soon as I'm out where I can do no further harm to the Constitution, it will cease." Taft suggested a different, if equally portentous, interpretation. "You're wrong," he told his old friend. "It is my storm. I always said it would be a cold day when I got to be president." The street department was already hard at work clearing snow from Pennsylvania Avenue, but there was no time to remove the yellowish, slimy, shoe-penetrating mush from the sidewalks. In front of every structure with windows on the street, candy stores, pawnbrokers' shops, undertaking parlors, Chinese restaurants, machine shops, carpenters had been busy week-long building seats which the owners planned to sell at a premium. By mid-morning, melancholy enveloped the proprietors of the small shops along the parade route. With wet snow still blanketing the city, prices began to plummet. Seats expected to garner $5 sold for $1. Sandwiches, priced at a dime, could be had for 3 cents. Despite the severe conditions, people stood three deep on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, prepared to cheer and wave as the carriage bearing the president and president-elect moved slowly toward the Capitol. Unfortunately, hardly a glimpse of the two could be seen through the windows, for a driving snow had forced the coachmen to close the top of the carriage. At the Capitol, more than 10,000 hearty souls waited to take their seats in the open stands to witness the inaugural ceremony. Inside, the inaugural committee debated whether to move the ceremony to the Senate chamber for the first time since President Jackson's second inaugural. Reluctant to disappoint the eager crowd, Taft fought to keep the ceremony on the Capitol Plaza. If so many spectators could endure the cold merely to see the sight, he argued, he certainly could endure it. The president-elect conceded only when advised that the elderly Chief Justice and several members of Congress and the diplomatic corps might be imperiled by the exposure. The disheartening news was blared to the expectant crowd through megaphones. "All exercises will be conducted in the Senate chamber, and no one will be admitted there unless he has a ticket." No longer an open, public ceremony, the inaugural was attended by members of Congress, high government officials, Supreme Court justices, and ambassadors. Cheers erupted when Roosevelt and Taft entered, walking arm in arm down the aisle. Hale and hearty as Mr. Roosevelt looked, the Sun reported, he was dwarfed by Mr. Taft's generous proportions. Appropriately, William Howard Taft took the oath of office on the same Bible used for decades to swear in Supreme Court justices. Then, speaking in a slow, distinct voice, which carried to the furthest reaches of the chamber, he delivered his inaugural address. "For the first time in a century," correspondents observed, "the assembled guests could actually hear the president's words." While he felt the heavy weight of responsibility to preserve and enforce regulatory reforms initiated by his distinguished predecessor, Taft simultaneously reassured those businesses pursuing proper and progressive business methods. He pledged to secure amendments to both the antitrust and interstate commerce laws that would make a distinction between legitimate combinations and those formed with the intent of creating monopolies and artificially controlling prices. Pressing Roosevelt's agenda, he urged Congress to pass new conservation laws, consider a graduated inheritance tax, establish a postal savings bank system, and provide added protections to members of the working class. The scope of a modern government, he maintained, has been widened far beyond the principles laid down by the old laissez-faire school of political writers, and this widening has met popular approval. Finally, stepping into uncharted territory for his party, Taft called for a downward revision of the tariff and announced that he was summoning Congress into special session on March 15th for this purpose. When Taft finished, Roosevelt jumped up and climbed the steps to the raised platform. The new president turned to meet him, reporters observed, with a smile that irradiated his face. The departing president grinned all over. Then, with hands on each other's shoulders, they talked for several minutes. "God bless you, old man," Roosevelt exclaimed, calling his address a great state document. Witnesses of the emotional scene applauded like mad. Rather than ride together back to the White House, as custom dictated, the two men parted. Months earlier, Roosevelt had decided to go straight from the inaugural ceremony to Union Station. There he bid adieu to thousands of well-wishers with a short, heartfelt speech. A band played Auld Lang Syne, and amid deafening cheers, Roosevelt and Edith departed for Oyster Bay. Since Roosevelt had abandoned tradition, Nellie followed suit, deciding to do what no president's wife had ever done, accompany her husband from the Capitol to the White House. Some of the inaugural committee expressed their disapproval, she recalled, but I had my way, and in spite of protests, took my place at my husband's side. Although a bitter wind still scoured the streets, the snow had stopped and the new president insisted the carriage top remain open. Drawn by four horses, the carriage elicited a continuous cheer from the thousands of visitors unable to witness either the oath of office or Taft's address. "Three cheers for the First Lady," a voice shouted along their route. Seeing his wife's radiant smile, Taft took up the cheer himself, and soon the entire crowd was hailing the First Lady. That drive was the proudest and happiest event of Inauguration Day, Nellie recalled. My responsibilities had not yet begun to worry me, and I was able to enjoy, almost to the full, the realization that my husband was actually President of the United States. Newspapers predicted the genial new president would usher in an era of good feelings. Taft has no enemies of his own making. He is not taking over any of the enemies of his predecessor, observed Walter Wellman. The change of administration signaled peace and reassurance rather than the atmosphere of vituperation and denunciation that had marked the final months of Roosevelt's tenure. While progressives trusted Taft to continue his mentor's work, conservatives took comfort that judicial poise had succeeded erratic temperament, that decisions would now be made with deliberation, not drama. Never did any man, the Sun editorialized, arrive at the White House with such universal goodwill. Already questioning his own competence for the nation's highest office, Taft found such grand expectations unnerving. Asked a week after his inauguration how he liked being president, he confessed that he remained disoriented. "I hardly know yet. When I hear someone say, 'Mr. President,' I look around expecting to see Roosevelt. And when I read in the headlines of the morning papers that the President and Senator Aldrich and Speaker Cannon have had a conference, my first thought is, I wonder what they talked about. So you can see that I have not gone very far yet." Roosevelt's departure for Africa on March 23rd signaled opportunity as well as anxiety for Taft. For years, Archie Budd observed, Taft had been living on the steam of Theodore Roosevelt, propelled by the outsized personality and ambition of his friend and chief. "He will have to find his own fuel now," Butt conjectured, "and, like a child, will have to learn to walk alone. There is not the slightest doubt in my mind that he will learn to walk alone and will walk possibly all the better, but it is going to be a readjustment just the same." Initially, Captain Butt had hesitated to accept Taft's offer and remain in the White House, fearing he would not be able to serve the new president with the same devotion he continued to feel toward his predecessor. The influence of Mr. Roosevelt over those around him is masterful, and his friends become fanatical. For example, to wit, I, he told his sister Clara. He had great admiration and liking for Taft, however, and considered Nellie an intellectual woman and a woman of wonderful executive ability. He had been in the Philippines when Taft was Governor General, and had seen how the Filipino people had responded to the warmth and openness of the big man's personality. While Butt acknowledged at the start that he missed Roosevelt's marvelous wit, he found his new chief a most enjoyable companion. He is essentially a gregarious animal, Butt reflected. He likes to have someone in the car with him when he is reading or studying, and if he is at work, he works better if he has someone in the room with him. Despite Taft's initial reservations, his first 2 months in office augured well for the new administration. Early on, he decided that his White House would be open to all. He would not, like Roosevelt, compile a list of undesirables. There would be no abrupt and stormy attacks on fellow politicians. Reflecting on the animosity between the President and Congress that had consumed the country since the previous December, Taft resolved to end such recrimination. I hope that I shall never be called upon ever to say anything in disparagement of senators and members of the House. I have no desire to belittle them. As Governor General of the Philippines, Taft had welcomed every political group at the Malacañang Palace, making it a rule never to pay any attention to personal squabbles and differences. He hoped to institute the same policy as president. Aware that access to the White House was an enormous political asset, Taft announced a series of a half-dozen formal dinner parties designed to unify all the warring factions in the House and Senate. I am rather proud of these lists, he told Archie Butt. I do not believe there were given 6 dinners at the White House where more thought has been expended than on these 6. He was careful to include Senator Joseph Bailey, despite the fact that just a month earlier the Texas Democrat had pronounced Taft wholly unsuited for the presidency. And Bailey appeared to appreciate the gesture. I've come to pay my tribute and respects to a most agreeable personality, Bailey declared at the event. Taft also lifted Roosevelt's ban on Senator Tillman of South Carolina and invited dozens of rank-and-file congressmen who had not previously attended a White House dinner. Where Roosevelt had dispensed White House invitations to pay for favors already performed and loyalty which had been proven, Taft hoped his magnanimity would induce future cooperation. The volatile guest list for the first of these affairs, which included Old Guard Republicans and their progressive antagonists, Northern Democrats and Southern Populists, created the liveliest interest in the Capitol. Fortunately, one reporter noted, ladies had been invited to keep these belligerent congressmen apart. Even with their mollifying influence, some suggested, the situation might require all of President Taft's diplomacy to keep things going smoothly. In the end, good food, good wine, and the music of the Marine Band made the first dinner a notable success, setting an agreeable precedent for the 5 events planned for the future. It is undoubtedly Mr. Taft's purpose to conciliate, observed a Northwestern paper. He doesn't like discord. He thinks it would be possible to get all the good men of the country together on a common platform, the Roosevelt men and the anti-Roosevelt men. During the weeks that followed, reporters kept a tally of the undesirables once again finding their way to the White House. Democratic Senator Augustus Bacon of Georgia was pleased as a boy with his first invitation in 7 years. Senators Hale, Aldrich, Payne, and a lot of other ungodly stand-patters were again welcomed in the president's home, as were the most fervent Roosevelt men. Rather than wielding the big stick through the press to prod legislative action, Taft hoped that personal appeal and reasoned arguments would prevail. Reporters, too, delighted in the startling contrast evident in Taft's method of handling the hundreds of audience seekers from that of his predecessor. Senators, congressmen, and all manner of officials appeared during the morning hours between 10 and 12. To expedite matters, Roosevelt had kept his door open, entertaining a dozen or more callers simultaneously with his snappy banter, sending them on their way out almost before they realized they were in. One visitor described his experience as being caught in a strong draft. Taft possessed none of Roosevelt's terminal facilities. He invited callers individually into his office, closed the door, and reportedly made everyone feel so much at home that they were inclined to linger all morning. At the pace he conducted business, Archie Butt worried, Taft would be about 3 years behind on the final day of his term. Taft extended the window for callers an additional hour and a half, interrupting the flow of visitors only to take his lunch. Unlike Roosevelt, who famously invited people from all walks of life to his table, Taft generally ate alone. Forever struggling to lose weight, he limited his midday meal to an apple or a glass of water. One visitor, having reportedly waited 3 hours to see him, was finally invited into the president's office with an unceremonious greeting. "I'm glad you have come in," Taft told him, "but you will have to wait until I've had my luncheon." When the weary caller asked how long it would be, Taft's only reply was to pick up a pitcher of water and pour himself a glass. When he finished drinking, he returned to his desk. "Now I am through. What do you want to tell me?" Meetings with governmental officials and lawmakers often stretched until 5 o'clock, after which Taft, like Roosevelt, took time to exercise. "There the resemblance ended," one White House correspondent remarked. Roosevelt took strenuous hikes or played in vigorous tennis matches. Taft much preferred a leisurely round of golf. As a horseman, Roosevelt jumped hurdles, forded creeks, and sought out unused bridle paths, another reporter noted, while the new president trotted along the riverfront or around the ellipse. Before long, even these placid forays were replaced by late afternoon spins in one of the 3 new White House automobiles. Roosevelt had displayed no interest in what critics called devil wagons, but Taft fell in love with them on the first whirl. In short order, he converted the stable, which had held Roosevelt's jumpers, pacers, and calipers, into an oversized garage for his Model M steam touring convertible, capable of seating 7 passengers, a Pierce Arrow limousine, and a Baker Queen Victoria electric, which Nellie learned to drive. Diverted by their superficial differences in style, the journalists initially failed to recognize a far more consequential contrast between the two men, their differing attitudes toward the press. More than any previous president, Theodore Roosevelt had treated journalists as intimates. Covering the White House had been a reporter's paradise for 7 years. No president ever lived on better terms with the newspapermen than did Roosevelt, reporter Gus Karger proclaimed. He addressed them by their first names, inquired about their families, and shared confidential anecdotes and gossip. He chatted with them during his midday shave, invited conversation while he signed his mail, and welcomed their company on his private railroad car. Most important, as one historian wrote, he made the White House hum with activity, and in the process gave the correspondents who covered him the best ongoing story in generations. Now that colorful story had come to an end. "There will be someone at the White House whom you will like more than me," Roosevelt had predicted during his final meeting with the press corps, "but not one who will interest you more." As Secretary of War, Taft had enjoyed an easy rapport with members of the press, who frequented his office to secure gossip, information, and anecdotes. It was a favorite occupation for the correspondents, Oscar King Davis recalled, to go tafting, to meet with the secretary in the late afternoon for a half hour or so of very pleasant conversation, which often furnished a good deal of news. Always a good scout, Taft had spoken frankly and depended on reporter friends to protect his occasional indiscretions. In his first weeks as president, however, Taft discovered that casual remarks made headlines and quickly recognized the necessity of care in everything he disclosed. Rather than hold informal daily discussions with members of the press, he would see individual journalists by appointment only. Nonetheless, the new president promised to meet with the entire group of correspondents on a weekly basis. Before he discontinued these press conferences, the White House reporters developed a genuine affection for the big, good-humored man who had taken the place of the strident, dynamic Roosevelt. Taft was beginning to create his own atmosphere, Archie Butt remarked in late April. People are forgetting that he is the residuary legatee, and his smile, good nature, and evenness of temper are winning hearts to him. The press and the public seem to have reached a similar verdict about the new occupant of the White House. Roosevelt made good with people, and Taft promises to do likewise, one reporter noted. Take it all in all, another concluded. Washington is mighty happy in these opening days of the Taft administration. If Taft professed to be a fish out of water in his new office, Nellie was finally entirely in her element. The new president frequently touted his wife's strengths, maintaining that without her guidance, he would never have sought and never gained the presidency. I am no politician, he told a gathering in Georgia shortly after his election. There, he proudly indicated Nellie, is the politician of the family. If she had only let me alone, I guess I should now be dozing on the circuit court bench. Her acumen, he insisted proudly, had facilitated every critical step of his career. Indeed, he held that without her tact and diplomacy, he would never have succeeded in the Philippines. Now he had faith that Nellie would share the responsibilities of his new office and once again prove instrumental in surmounting the formidable challenges he would face. Journalists latched onto Taft's narrative, emphasizing Nellie's decisive role in her husband's political ascendancy. Their comradeship, the Ladies' Home Journal observed, was like that of two men who are intimate chums. A portrait emerged of an ambitious wife who championed her viewpoints with almost masculine vigor, while Taft assumed his most judicial attitude. Article after article highlighted Nellie's role in her husband's choice to leave the Cincinnati Superior Court to become Solicitor General, and then to relinquish his federal judgeship and become Governor General of the Philippines. Yes, Nellie acknowledged, it is true that I urged Mr. Taft to give up his position on the bench and return to politics. I felt that while he honored and loved his legal position more than all else in his career, he might spend the younger years of his life in a wider field. Again, reporters observed, Nellie's judgment prevailed when Taft turned down Roosevelt's third offer for the Supreme Court to test the waters for the presidency. A week after his victory, Nellie was asked if she studied politics. Indeed I do, she replied in her usual forthright manner. I have studied the situation gravely, and I think I understand it well. Few women have gone into the White House so well equipped to meet the exactions of the First Lady's position, remarked the New York Times. As the Governor General's wife, she had already served in a similar capacity. She acutely understood the importance of getting out among the people, appreciated the ceremonial aspects of her role, and was well versed in the rules of etiquette required for her position. Her knowledge of Spanish, French, and German enabled her to speak freely with the diplomats and natives of numerous countries. You make me feel truly at home when you converse with me in French, Ambassador Jusserand told her. Nellie's extensive travels had provided her with myriad stories and anecdotes to entertain such dignitaries. The new First Lady was never at a loss for conversation, a reporter for the New York Tribune wrote. Never within the recollection of Washingtonians of today, claimed another correspondent, had a First Lady shown herself so conversant on any subject of contemporaneous interest. Asked how she found time to keep up so thoroughly with world events, Nellie rejoined with droll simplicity, by reading the daily papers. His first interview with Nellie Taft left the Ladies' Home Journal reporter George Griswold Hill impressed with her dignity. He remarked upon her unusual acuity and shrewd insight into people and situations. She surveys the man or woman presented to her with a look so calm and deliberate, Hill observed, that strangers sometimes are wont to describe her as cold. Beneath her cloak of composure, however, Hill discerned a charming and sensitive woman. A New York Times reporter was similarly taken with the clever new First Lady. Her smile has the charm of intelligence, he reported. That quick flash of recognition, distinct from the frozen automatic smile peculiar to many women in official life. As the president's wife, Nelly announced early on, she considered herself a public personage and would cheerfully meet any demands the position made upon her. Her statement revealed a far different temperament from that of her predecessor. Even after 7 years as First Lady, Edith Roosevelt had remained unwilling to look upon herself otherwise than as a private individual. Believing that a woman's name should appear in print but twice, when she is married and when she is buried, Edith had refrained from publicly voicing political opinions and routinely declined interview requests. In a rare portrait piece entitled Mrs. Roosevelt, The Woman in the Background, Mabel Daggett portrayed Edith Roosevelt as an intensely private and traditional wife and mother. She presents none of the restless new woman attributes, Daggett wrote. She throbs for no reforms. She champions no causes. Surrounded by her boisterous family, Edith was described as a happy woman, adored by her husband. Edith Roosevelt, Daggett concluded, would intentionally step out into history as one of the least known first ladies. Before she took up residence in the White House, Nellie Taft made it clear she would play a far different role. In December 1908, she agreed to become honorary chair of the Women's Welfare Department of the National Civic Federation, NCF, a progressive organization founded to better the working lives of wage earners employed in government and industry positions. No previous First Lady had taken a commanding lead in promoting controversial programs to improve public welfare. At the annual meeting, Nellie delivered a well-received speech calling for investigations into the working conditions of female employees in federal and state departments, post offices, public hospitals, and police stations. She plainly showed, one attendee noted, that she has brains and used them without any sense of being aggressive or pedantic. During the NCF banquet at the Waldorf Astoria in New York the following evening, she was observed in animated conversation with the union leader Samuel Gompers. Not all Washingtonians approved of Nellie's unconventional activism. A traditionalist, Archie Butt, predicted that Nellie would make a fine mistress of the White House, but only if she would refrain from speaking publicly about the betterment of the working girl class, instead focusing upon the simple duties of First Lady. Public policy affecting working women was not the only issue on which Nellie expressed a strong opinion. Asked about granting suffrage to women, she answered with her usual directness, "The woman's voice is the voice of wisdom, and I can see nothing unwomanly in her casting the ballot." In fact, Nellie fervently rejected traditional restrictions on a woman's role in society, insisting that intellectual development did not in any way diminish her capabilities in the home. Nothing in a college education, she maintained, makes a girl either unfit for domestic obligations or masculine in her tastes. Some women are not called on to preside over a home. And for those who did marry and have children, education would make them great in intellect and soul. Her daughter Helen, she noted with pride, had chosen to take a full college course at the National Cathedral School, then secured a prestigious scholarship to Bryn Mawr College. While Nellie appreciated the distinct advantages for a young girl in the social life of the White House, she fully supported her daughter's decision to pursue her education elsewhere. With her progressive views, one reporter noted, Mrs. Taft had endeared herself to that class of women who are sometimes slightingly referred to as strong-minded. Despite Captain Butt's concern, Nellie's political activities did nothing to interfere with her duties as mistress of the White House. In fact, the new First Lady had ambitious plans to make the national capital the hub of American cultural life. The White House, she argued, belonged to the people, and she would conduct social affairs there on a plane of the highest and broadest democracy. She hoped that Washington would someday supplant New York as the real social center of the country. In the capital, she envisioned a national society comprised of the best people in the land, a society not founded on the dollar, but on culture, art, statesmanship. No other city, she maintained, is more beautifully laid out or has more natural charm during the months given over to official and social life. New Yorkers reacted with scorn, calling the First Lady's idea as absurd as it is impracticable, insisting that New York has been and always will be the mecca of culture